I want to extend a very warm welcome to Counselor Lloyd Gardner, who's with us, and I think there are at least two other members of that institution, two board members, Stephen Ader, I know I see, and Sam McClelland is someplace in the back of the back here from the United States. I don't know if there are any of the other board members present, but you're very welcome indeed, and particularly so at this session, which is to be addressed by Amitul Baha, member of that same institution. The institution, incidentally, that has been designated as that of the learned in the Baha'i writings. One of the great, one of the greatest literary treasures, I think, that the Baha'i community has is that extraordinary book entitled The Priceless Pearl. Just how great a literary treasure it is, how great a historical treasure we only future generations will appreciate when we've moved some distance further from the age that the Guardian lived in and begin to appreciate more appropriately the magnitude of his station and of the work that he accomplished. But for any of us who are familiar at all with the work of trying to write biography or write history, this book is a masterpiece. The task of seizing up a mass of material on that scale and organizing it into a graceful and coherent and just whole would simply stagger, I think, most scholars. To do that when you are dealing with the life and work of a figure who combined, among other things, in his life a dozen or more careers that would have satisfied and established the reputation of a score of great figures, really makes must have made the job extremely daunting. And to have the whole thing weighted as well with those extra imperatives that most scholars don't have, of the authority that must inevitably attach to that kind of memoir by someone so intimately, uniquely associated with the Guardian of the Baha'i Faith, I think, I can't conceive what went on in Rehanum's mind when she attempted to cope with the job that she found herself addressing herself to. And I'm sure that, it's only as we move further in history from the figure of Shoghi Effendi that we'll begin to appreciate the kind of scholarship, the Baha'i scholarship that this work represents. I don't say anything about her other works, Prescription for Living, The Manual for Pioneers. I will take a chance, since I'm the chairman, I have a firm hold at the moment on the microphone, of telling her right to openly how absolutely delighted I am with a particular piece of writing she did, and that's that beautiful memoir of Horace Holley. That is one of the most beautifully crafted pieces of biographical writing I think I have ever read. If you read it, you should read it and read it and read it again. Read between the lines. I know something about the writing of biography. I know how tremendously difficult it is to say things and say them appropriately with a life like that. And she did a really magnificent job. That's the side of Rehanum as a scholar. There are other sides which we're all very much familiar with, and I wouldn't attempt to speak of those on this occasion, except to tell her that we love her very much and we're very grateful for her. Amitul Baha Rehanum.
Doug gave a very loving and warm introduction, and it reminded me of the story of the little tailor. I don't know what people in this room were brought up on, but I was brought up, I think, to my great spiritual advantage, and I mean spiritual, on the old fairy tales. And you remember the story of the little tailor, the valiant little tailor, seven at a blow, and how high he went in society. I forget, I think he became the confidant of the king or the king himself or something, because he made a great capital out of the fact of seven at one blow. But what he neglected to say was that it was seven flies on a piece of jam bread. it wasn't seven giants he'd killed, it was just seven flies that he'd swatted. So perhaps the introduction of my abilities is a little like that. Doug tried hard three or four times up here behind the screen of that thing to get out of me what was going to be my topic. And I said that I didn't know, but that I was going to speak on what was dearest to my heart. And of course then that made him all the more curious. He wanted to know what was dearest to my heart. And that is what I want to really talk about. And then later on, if I'm still alive and up here, we can have some questions. You know, I have, and I'm very, very glad that I can voice these thoughts to what I would call a valuable audience. I think that this Baha'i Studies business, where is our name? Always forget it. I think this association, Baha'i Studies, is really a very, very wonderful thing. And I think that the most wonderful part of it is that it is enabling the Baha'is to tap different reservoirs of thought and get the faith in front of people that normally we haven't been able to reach. And I think also, undoubtedly, perhaps particularly amongst the youth, it is cultivating an ability on their part to study more deeply the teachings, to evaluate them, and digest and assimilate them into their personal lives. And I think all of that is wonderful. And we know that the House of Justice has been very happy over this thing that the Canadian National Assembly has started and has met with such a nice warm response from the Baha'is in Canada, and judging by the audience, many from the United States too. But what I think about it is that it's an opportunity to evaluate all kinds of things in relationship to us Baha'is and humanity. Because we are supposed, very unworthily, to be the bridge between the message of Baha'u'llah and the human race. Whoever is added unto us, they have the same privilege as we have of teaching the cause of God and of sharing the message of Baha'u'llah with other people. And because of that, I think that certain thoughts, if you agree with them, if I can put them over, in other words, might be of value, particularly in a body of this kind, where we have many people who are on national assemblies, local assemblies, councillors, board members, people who are interested in teaching the faith, people who have been and will be pioneers, and so on. And this is the subject that is dearest to my heart, which is teaching the faith to the people of the world. You see, we people in this room, and I am one of you, in the sense that I'm half American, I'm half Canadian, I'm a child of the city, I have lived my entire life in the midst of Western culture and Western materialism and in cities. And we are inclined, and I can assure you that on some subjects I really do know what I'm talking about, and this is one of them. I say, well, I'm not sure, it's my own personal opinion, but if I really know what I'm talking about, well, then I assert myself, and this I do assert, that we, without realizing it, as I see over and over again now in my travels, because, as you know, I travel very extensively, and the country that we came from last time, Jamaica, was my 135th country. And many of those have been more than one visit. Well, that's quite a lot. And you get a purview of developments and of people's thinking and of the Baha'is that you would not get just from your own community or one or two places. And I'm very sorry to say that everywhere I go, I find this debate going on. What kind of Baha'is are those? In other words, the illiterates, the villagers, the people who are enrolled quickly. They're called paper Baha'is. They're called paper spiritual. What's the matter with this thing? Papers. That's better. They're called papers. What's the matter with it? It doesn't seem to aim right. They're called paper spiritual assemblies. There's a dead point here. What am I supposed to do? Bite it or something? No, I'm perfectly serious. The other day, a young Baha'i was singing a Baha'i song in front of the mic, and he practically bit it. And I said, what's the matter with you? He said, I'm a professional, and in my profession, they teach you to bite the mic. So I don't know why this thing seems to have dead ends hanging around different parts. But can everybody hear clearly? Is it all right? All right. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that there is a very marked debate going on in the Baha'i faith between those who believe that people that are enrolled quickly are Baha'is, and those who believe that literates and people like ourselves in this room, the more degrees the better, the more education the better, that these are in some way or other the elite, and that it's the elite that are the chosen, it's the elite that are the important. Well, that's not borne out by Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah's doctrines are extremely interesting. I'm not talking about the wealth of detail of teachings we have and this and that, but I'm talking about his doctrines. One of his doctrines is that he says, all turned away from him, except them whom God was pleased to guide. In other words, God is pleased to guide certain people to his faith. He accepts certain people. Certain people are acceptable. Not everybody is either capable of recognizing Baha'u'llah, accepting him, or being acceptable to Baha'u'llah. And that is something that has nothing to do with your station or your race or your education or anything else. It's something evidently that is a very subtle thing between the soul of a man and his creator. So how can anybody presume in any station of life to say who God pleased to guide to his faith? In other words, who is to do the judging of another person and say whether they are a Baha'i or not? Who is to sit and say, this man, what does he know about the Baha'i faith? He can't possibly be a Baha'i with that much knowledge. Look at how much I know about it, you see. And you weigh him in your evaluation, usually of yourself, and usually a very conceited evaluation, and you find him wanting because he is not according to your concept of what a Baha'i should be and what a Baha'i should know to accept him. But it doesn't seem to be Baha'u'llah's concept, because his concept is that everybody in the whole world, at least reasonably and politely, should be informed of the existence of his faith, and then they should be given the opportunity to accept it, which is dependent on two things: acceptability in the eyes of God, and a capacity in that person to respond, which I suppose is fundamentally the same thing. This is Xerox, and it's not very clear. I'm sorry, I'll have to decipher it. In fact, there are going to be a lot of, hiatuses, so you'll have to be patient. He says, our mission is to seize and possess the hearts of men. Upon them the eyes of Baha are fixed. It's very extraordinary. He doesn't say a thing about the heads of men. He says, our mission is to seize the hearts of men. Upon them the eyes of Baha are fixed. Well, that includes the whole human race. There you get into just a quite a different category, because everybody has this heart faculty. Of course, we also all have an intellectual faculty too. But evidently, it's not the heads of mankind that he wishes to conquer. It's the hearts of mankind that he wishes to conquer. Having conquered the hearts, all right, then of course he wants to educate the heads. But it's a secondary thing. You see, the primary thing is to conquer the heart of the individual. Now, that is something, it has nothing whatsoever to do with education. I have had some experiences, which I think perhaps some of you have already heard, and at the risk of being boring for a few, I'll tell the others these experiences, because I think that they're very indicative of what I am talking about. We have, in this century, at the end of it, developed one of the most horrible and unjust prejudices that the world has ever seen. And I'm quite convinced of what I'm saying. We have racial prejudices. Baha'u'llah pointed these out to us. After all, his revelation is over 100 years old. Religious prejudices, class prejudices, national prejudices. But he didn't mention educational prejudices, because the state of learning in his days had not reached the point that it has now. But I can assure you that probably, in my estimation, the cruelest prejudice, much worse than class, race, religion, even although we're being killed in Persia, and political and so on, the cruelest prejudice in the world today and the most widely spread amongst people like yourselves is the prejudice of the educated against the uneducated. And I see it as I travel in all the Baha'i communities, not so much, to be fair, on the members of the national assemblies, very, very seldom a breath of it amongst the counselors, but I find it in many of the pioneers, and I find it in many members of the community, a definite prejudice against the illiterates, prejudice against people who have not had the advantages of not only going through high school and probably university and maybe more than one degree, haven't got air conditioning in their homes, don't live on Main Street, haven't got an air-conditioned car, are not in the financial bracket of the person that has the prejudice. Well, I'd like to know where any human being can find this in the Baha'i faith. It's so outrageous that it doesn't bear thinking about. And yet consciously, or unconsciously, to be fair to the Baha'is, I think it's mostly unconsciously, this is a prejudice that is not only rampant in the world, but it's also prevalent amongst a great many Baha'is. And I'm sorry, friends, you can have it right in the teeth. It's just as strong with the Persians as it is with the non-Persians. It's just as strong in one part of the world as it is in another. It is the prejudice of the educated, the intellectual, what they consider upper class, against the uneducated masses of the people of the world. Well, it's not only not Baha'i, but it isn't borne out by facts, because it's a false evaluation of other people. I remember once in a news conference in the Ivory Coast, a very intelligent young group of journalists were questioning me and badgering me. And then finally one of them said, how does one become a Baha'i? Well, I said, people like yourself, you become Baha'is through asking questions and reading books, evaluating it in your mind. Because this is the method that you have been trained through your educational background to do, to use. But, I said, the villager, where we go out and teach a great deal of the time, has no possibility of evaluating it on that basis. He evaluates it intuitively in his heart. And it's often an instantaneous sense of that this is right or this is wrong, you see. Now, unless the Baha'is will accept that, they're never going to be able, I believe, to serve the cause of God the way they should. And I don't care whether you're all people in this very valuable kind of a gathering that we have here today, or whether you're people out pioneering, or who you are. To me, it's a fact, and you have to recognize that.